From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a writer who is intimately acquainted with Homer, Marge, Bart, and Lisa. We talk with Al Jean. He's worked on The Simpsons since the start of the series and is a producer and writer of the new Simpsons movie. The voice of Bart has always been done by Nancy Cartwright. She's become middle-aged while Bart has remained 10 years old. We'll talk with her about getting into character. She also does the voices of Nelson Muntz, Ralph Wiggum, and Todd Flanders. The Simpsons, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Homer, Marge, Bart, and Lisa are about to become movie stars. The new movie adaptation of America's longest-running sitcom opens tomorrow. My guest Al Jean has worked on The Simpsons since it became a series in 1989. He's currently head writer and an executive producer. And he's a writer and producer of The Simpsons movie. Let's start with a scene from the film. The story has a satirical environmental theme. Homer has adopted a pet pig and has no idea what to do with the pig's droppings. So he fills a silo with the stinky stuff, but then can't figure out what to do with the silo. In a move he thinks is pretty clever, Homer dumps the silo in Springfield's already polluted lake, creating an environmental catastrophe. When the townspeople find out, they want revenge. In this scene, an angry mob of men and women carrying torches is in front of the Simpsons' house.
Homer, you have to go out there, face that mob, and apologize for what you did.
I would. I'm afraid if I open the door, they'll take all of you.
No, we won't. We just want Homer.
Well, maybe not you, but they'll kill Grandpa.
I'm part of the mob.
Al Jean, welcome back to Fresh Air. The Simpsons have been on the air nearly 20 years, and the characters never age, which is okay because they're animated. But I think some of them have really kind of changed and changed with the times. You want to choose one or two characters and tell us how you think they've changed?
Well, there have been some changes that weren't intentional, just because although the characters don't age, you know, we the writers certainly have. And right. At the beginning, I think we identified more with the kids because we almost were kids. And as we started to continue doing the show, more plots would come up for Homer. And I think that's, you know, because, you know, we were getting older and we related to him better. And honestly, as the years go by, I'm starting to drift into grandpa territory. So maybe that'll be the next way we go.
Did you have children while you were working on The Simpsons?
Yes, I have two daughters, one 16 and one 2.
Did you ever go through a parenting moment where you thought, oh no, I did that just like Homer?
I you know, do things like Homer, although they usually go the other way. I do them and then they, you know, find their way into the show. Like one thing that I did was years ago, I had a 6-foot party sub in my refrigerator left over from a party, and I would continue eating it, you know, to the point where it really wasn't good for me. And of course, with Homer, we did it to the point where he actually started turning blue and shaking, but still eating the sandwich. And, you know, everybody who works on the show has similar stories.
Now, just go through the titles that you've had over the years on The Simpsons.
Well, at the beginning, I was called a consulting producer. And the thing was, the people who are turning the shorts into half-hour episodes, which was Jim Brooks, Matt Groening, and Sam Simon, could afford 2 writers 2 days a week. So my friends didn't want the job, but I basically said, I'll work cheap and I'll work hard. And, you know, seriously, I also felt I wasn't, you know, predicting this was going to be a show that would last, you know, over 400 episodes and turn into a feature film. But I loved Matt's work in Life in Hell, and Sam and Jim, the work they had done on Taxi, and Jim and Mary Tyler Moore was the best work I thought had ever been done in television. So I really was excited to take the job, and I thought the show was going to be good, if nothing else. And when it became full-time, I became the showrunner in seasons 3 and 4. And after that, worked on it part-time while I pursued other projects, which a lot of the writers did then. And at every point, I would always sit there and sometime during the day and go, I wish I was back at The Simpsons. So I came back full-time in season 10, and I've been there full-time ever since and have run the show from season 13 till now.
What does it mean to be the showrunner?
Being the showrunner basically means that whatever goes wrong is my fault. I'm involved in all phases. I came up as a writer, so I write. I supervise the writing. I work with the budgets. I direct the actors, audio. I work with the animation directors. I go over the storyboards, edit the audio, edit the picture, work with the composer, Alf Clausen, work on the special effects, the sound effects, the video effects that go into the show. Basically, I involve myself with every aspect of the show and have responsibility for it.
So what was the first Simpsons episode you worked on?
The first Simpsons episode I worked on was the first episode that aired, the half-hour Christmas special in 1989. And the episode was basically written by Sam Simon, Matt Groening, Mike Reese, and myself. And when I first saw it as a final cut, I was sitting there going, this is the best thing I've ever been involved with. I want to just spend the rest of my career doing this. And little did I dream.
What did you like so much about it?
Well, what I liked was what I had always responded to in Jim Brooks shows, which was it was funny, but there was a warmth to it. And at the end of that episode, Homer didn't get a Christmas bonus, but he goes to the dog track and loses all his money, but then gets a dog that the owner doesn't want and brings the dog home, and the family's happy with him because he did. And there was a warmth to that that was so wonderful, and that we have recaptured on the best moments in the series, that I still get choked up a little thinking about it.
Do you remember the first joke that you contributed to The Simpsons?
I don't remember the first. I know that the very first episode is titled Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, and I pitched that. I remember the first time I really made Jim Brooks laugh was in that episode. We were talking about the name for the dog, and I had said, it was Christmas, so because it should be a good omen and Homer would want to bet on him, we could say Santa's Little Helper. And then we were doing this thing where Homer came home, and Marge said, what's the dog's name? And I pitched, because it had been a greyhound at a racetrack, that Homer goes, number 8. I mean, Santa's Little Helper. And he really laughed at that. And I just was going, wow, I made Jim Brooks really laugh. That's exciting.
Were there any characters you created?
Yes, Ralph Wiggum was one of the characters that we created. I also was one of the people that created Phil Hartman's characters, Lionel Hutz and Troy McClure, and comic book guy. And much of the show was in the shorts and, was elaborated in the series. The first episode featuring Lisa, Moaning Lisa, was from an idea of Jim's, and Mike Reese and I wrote it. And when we did, we said, we've been on shows that were a little sketchier, like Alf or the first Gary Shandling show. We're going to really go for emotion here. And it was something that I was, so proud of when we did it. And I think it really helped make Lisa's character what it became.
You mentioned Troy McClure, one of the Phil Hartman characters. I'm so sorry that Phil Hartman passed away a few years ago.
He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah, you really lost a lot of characters, and I'm sure a great friend when he died. But getting back to Troy McClure, he was this like really funny, vain character. There seemed to be a combination of two actors. Troy McClure. Troy Donahue and
Doug McClure.
Doug McClure.
Both of whom were angered by the name.
Were they really?
Yeah.
Would you describe how you came up with the character?
Well, the name synthesis is a good example of how we come up with things. We were working on a rewrite for a script in which Homer steals Cable, and we wanted to have this movie actor who comes out and, he introduces cheesy products, and he's a guy who's been in these terrible movies. And, we were saying, he should be a combination of Troy Donahue and Doug McClure. We'll call him Troy McClure. And often things aren't, more fleshed out than that. I would read on The Sopranos that, David Chase would know where he wanted to go with everything at the beginning of the season, and it would all be mapped out, and every, thing would be delineated in fine detail. Well, not us. I mean, I can give you another example, which is Principal Skinner, at one point, George Meyer, one of the writers, said, oh, you know, it'd be interesting if he was a Vietnam veteran. And it was just a joke, and it went in the script. And then it turned into something where it was a great character trait, and it gave him real poignancy. And, you know, we rarely, you know, plan things, but they grow organically, like kudzu.
You know, Krusty the Clown is this really, like, old-time Jewish vaudevillian type of comic. Clown, I mean. And Flanders is the fundamentalist Christian next-door neighbor. Are there like, Jewish writers and Christian writers and Catholic writers and atheist writers on the show who, like, know their territory?
Primarily, the staff throughout the years has been either writers who are Jewish or Catholic. I am a lapsed Catholic. And the thing that happens is if you're writing about your own ethnicity, then you feel like you can be funnier and you don't have to worry about political correctness. So, for example, we did an episode a couple of years ago where we depicted Catholic heaven and it was, you know, a bunch of Irishmen fighting. I'm Irish, so I didn't think that was offensive. I thought it would be really great and, you know, kills me every time I see it. You know, I think that's, you know, the way that these sort of things get into the show. Flanders, I always say, is designed as someone who's too good to be true. And, you know, I actually believe a lot of people who are fundamentalist Christians really like the character. And, you know, to me, Flanders is a much better neighbor than Homer. If I had to pick one to live next to, it would be Ned. So I find it's a portrait that's not sort of a cheap shot, but actually very nuanced and respectful.
He's a very, you know, considerate, loving father and a good neighbor.
And terrific to Homer, despite the things that Homer does to him.
Uh-huh. But what are some of the other sides of him that you've done over the years?
Well, like anything, as we, you know, continue to try to think of stories, we get more nuanced. So we have done things later, we have done things more recently where we'll have Ned, you know, watch TV and monitor it for vulgarisms. Or, you know, we had him making a movie like Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which was a Bible story, filming the Bible the way it's really written, which is pretty violent. And then he got in trouble because nobody wanted to see it. But we also, you know, make him somebody, and he has a big part in the movie where, you know, Bart looks at him and goes, he's a wonderful man, and everything that I don't see in my own father, I see in him. And that's a real conflict in the film.
Well, he's also just so fastidious. this is a very funny moment in the movie. He's putting the kids to bed, and I think, like, he gave them a little snack.
That's my favorite scene in the film.
Then he has one of those little mini vacuum cleaners that he's, like, vacuuming their bedclothes with as he puts them to bed.
There's a line that he says towards the end of the film where one of his kids goes, I wish Homer was my father, and I pitched, then Ned says, and I wish you didn't have the devil's curly hair. But he says it in such a positive manner. And my wife with his curly hair is like, now you've done it.
You know, speaking of the Bible, there's a joke in the movie, I hope you don't mind too much me giving this away, that where, you know, the family's in church, and I won't give away what's happening in church, but one of the characters says, basically, what should we do? And Homer has the Bible in his hands, and he says, I don't know, there's no answers in this book.
He says this book doesn't have any answers, and that was my line.
That's your line?
yes. But what it is just so people don't misconstrue it, it's him trying to find a solution for Grandpa, who's having a vision and rolling around on the floor. So the joke is that he's looking through the Bible like an owner's manual, you know, so that he can find a button to push, and that'll take care of Grandpa. And, you know, obviously, then there's the double meaning that people look for answers to life's problems in the Bible. And it gets a big laugh every time that we screen the film. And to me, it's a perfect example of, you know, the double meaning of you know, things that we do on The Simpsons. That scene, too, in the film that you're referring to is one at the beginning of the film where what Jim Brooks wanted to do was he wanted to have a scene that grabbed you and made you say, this is where the plot of the movie starts. And it's what often happens on The Simpsons, where the way the scene is written, we actually conclude there is a very active God who's taking a firm interest in the lives of Springfielders and trying to save them from a terrible fate. And we actually, you know, show more activity, you know, by, you know, God in human life and you know, direct involvement in human affairs than I would say any cartoon on network television.
My guest is Al Jean, an executive producer and writer of The Simpsons TV show and a producer and writer of the new Simpsons movie. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Jean, and he's been with The Simpsons since the very start, serving in just about every capacity, mostly running the show, and he's an executive producer and writer of the new Simpsons movie. Let's talk process a little bit. Can you just like walk us through the process of, say, a typical Simpsons show or of the movie? I assume the process was very similar. It probably starts in the writer's room, right?
I will, and it's always the most boring answer I can give to a question, but I'll try to be quick. What happens is that a writer or a couple of writers will pitch an idea for an episode, and as the showrunner, I decide which ones we do and don't do. And if it sounds like it's a good idea, and I always think, you know, would Jim Brooks like it? Sometimes I consult with him directly, or, you know, if I think he'll like it, we just go ahead and do it. And that writer will pitch with the group of writers for 3 days, just coming up with jokes, a storyline. The writer goes off, does an outline. I'll read that and give notes with a couple of other producers, tell the writer how to go off and write the first draft of the script. Then that draft is rewritten 6-7 times before the cast gets to see it. We really go over it line by line, story point by story point, joke by joke. We read it with the cast for a group of us that work on the show. Then you see what gets laughs and what doesn't. You see if they're on board for the story. In, you know, extreme cases, but not often, you'll go, oh, this thing doesn't work, or it's too off character, and we'll have to adjust the story too. Then we'll rewrite it for all that, record it on the following Monday. The audio tape is sent to the animation studio where it's storyboarded. And the storyboards are gone over by me and the writer, and they go back and make what's called an animatic, which is a rough black and white version with, you know, some of the animation in and not all of it. And that is screened for us, and we rewrite it again and record new audio. And then it's color animated. And even after the color comes back, we still rewrite it. A story I always tell is that in the early days of the show, we wrote a joke about the Soviet Union. And before the color came back, the Soviet Union broke up, and we had to change the joke. And, you know, because cartoon lip movements are, you know, pretty standard, you can really change what they say and you know, use the same animation. So the difference between that and the movie is the movie was a 4-year process, and the show, it's a 1-year process. And, you know, on television, you get used to letting things go. You do 22 episodes a year and you work as hard as you can, but you have to keep doing another one every week, and you can't just, you know, linger. On the movie, we didn't let go. We, you know, continued to rewrite it and rewrite it up until about a month prior to air. I mean, it really, and there were major changes that came in this year after test screenings that we had. We had them in Portland and Phoenix and San Diego. So it's a process that never stops. You're always trying to make it better.
What's the thing in your childhood that's closest to the Simpsons family?
Well, like I say, you know, to me, what's closest in the show is Lisa, because she is bookish and feels like, you know, people don't understand her. And when I would go to school, I would often think, I was... advanced 2 grades, so I was usually 2 years younger than everybody in my classes, and it had a somewhat alienating effect. You know, I would look at the world and think I was kind of distant from it, and I believe that's a philosophical point of view that a lot of comedy writers have. I've noticed comedy writers are often taller than average, you know, just in my, you know, statistically insignificant sample. And I think that, you know, that also contributes to a sense of they're not exactly, you know, attached to the public or the most popular people, and that they often have a distancing that enables them to look at things and then, you know, satirize them.
I have a margin Homer question for you. You know, Homer's really dumb.
Is he?
he's really difficult to put up with sometimes. And you know, Marge is always, well, often so kind of like stable and able to, you know, have everybody make up and be a family. No matter what Homer does, no matter how stupid it is, at the end, he and Marge usually reconcile, and the family's back together again.
Always reconcile.
Always reconcile. Yeah. Do you ever? Is ever a part of you that thinks, Marge, leave him? He's really stupid.
Yes, and that's the sort of feeling that, you know, we explore a little in depth in the film. What I think is, you know, one essential basis for the success of The Simpsons is Homer never does anything consciously mean, especially not to Marge. He's insensitive and he's made every mistake you can make, but he loves her and he doesn't want to hurt her for anything. And then on the other hand, Marge thinks Homer's the handsomest man she ever met.
Well, and like as Homer says in the film, you have to understand, I don't think about anything.
Yes. And then he goes, I respect people who do, but yeah, that's a Jim Brooks line. It's really, really funny.
So
there, also a good philosophy that a lot of us, I think, obey.
But there isn't a part of you that thinks, Marge, leave him.
All the time. Yeah, I mean, you know, there definitely is a you know, a recurring topic in the writer's room, which is, what does she see in him? And Julie Kavner is really funny because she goes, Homer must be great in bed. And when Julie says it, it's really funny to hear it coming out of her voice.
You know, he's probably not, don't you think?
Oh, he is. No, he is. I'm sure she's right. Yes, I think that's exactly correct.
Can animated characters get away with certain things that actors can't in a sitcom?
Absolutely. One of the biggest we always talk about is Homer strangles his son. I mean, he actually puts his hands around Bart's neck and chokes him. And I think in real life, that would be, Homer would go to jail. It'd be horrific. But in a cartoon, he does it. And then, you know, I mean, Bart's eyes bug out. I mean, it's really pretty scary when you look at it. But then he just lets go and Bart's fine. And it's a cartoon. Everything's cool.
Well, Al Jean, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Al Jean is a writer and producer of the new Simpsons movie and the TV show. Here's a scene from the TV series in which Homer is trying to save the local burlesque house from an angry mob. This is Fresh Air.
Sure, we could tear this house down.
No!
My friend, stop! Let me finish. We could tear it down, but we'd be tearing down a part of ourselves. You could close down Moe's or the Quickie Mart, and nobody would care. But the heart and soul of Springfield's Inn are Maison Derriere.
We're the sauce on your steak. We're the cheese in your cake.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of How to Talk to a Widower, a novel by Jonathan Tropper about coping with death, fatherhood, and learning to love again. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most, GatesFoundation.org. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the voice of Bart Simpson. We talk with Nancy Cartwright about playing America's most famous 10-year-old boy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, Bart, look at this. My dad took me to Circus of Values last night and said I could get anything I wanted.
Cool. An oversized novelty billiard ball.
Yeah, you shake it up and it tells the future.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Well, I passed my English test. Outlook not so good. Wow, it does work.
Let me try. Will I get beat up today? All signs point to yes.
That ball knows everything.
Two of the characters in that scene from The Simpsons TV show, Bart Simpson and Nelson Muntz, were voiced by my guest, Nancy Cartwright. She's done Bart's voice since the start, back when The Simpsons was a vignette on The Tracy Ullman Show. Cartwright has aged 20 years in the interim, but Bart has remained 10. Cartwright also does the voices of Ralph Wiggum and Todd Flanders on The Simpsons. She's done voices for other cartoons, too. Now she's a star of the new Simpsons movie, which opens tomorrow. Nancy Cartwright, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the way I understand the story, although you're the voice of Bart Simpson, when you first auditioned for The Simpsons, you auditioned for the voice of Lisa. How did you go from Lisa to Bart?
Well, you know, when I went in there, I was told by my agent that they wanted me to read for this 8-year-old middle child, and it wasn't really a show, it was an interstitial, and I'd never even heard that word before, so I, you know, queried, like, what is an interstitial? Oh, it's just a little mini entertainment wrapped around a commercial. And I thought, well, okay, fine, so who am I? Her name's Lisa Simpson, she's the 8-year-old middle child, it's a quirk, they're trying to put together this little family. Dan Castellaneta and Julie Kavner from The Tracy Ullman Show have already been cast as the voices for the mom and dad, and so now they're looking for the kids. So they want you to read for Lisa, and I said, oh, okay, I'll go in. And I went in, I saw the script there for Lisa and a picture of her, and it described her, you know, as 8-year-old middle child. I read it, and it seemed okay, but, you know, it was all right. No big deal, no teeth, really. But next to it was this audition of Bart with his picture, and it said, 10-year-old, school-hating, you know, underachiever and proud of it. And I thought, oh, my God, that sounds cool. And I read it, and it was just, to me, it just struck the heart of the 10-year-old boy inside me. So I went in and shook Matt Groening's hand, and I said, you know, I'm here to read for Lisa, but I saw the part for Bart, and I'd rather read for him. Do you mind? And he said, no, it's fine. So I gave him one shot, one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it. Blah, 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 blah. And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh, my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part. And I was given the part on the spot.
Can you talk a little bit about how you created Bart's voice?
Well, you know, typically when I've gone in, I've been in the business since 1981, and I'll get a call for a part on, at that time it was just syndicated television, it was Saturday Morning Fare, because there was no primetime animation in the early 80s, and I would go in for this Saturday morning, you know, My Little Pony, Glow Friends, Snorks, Pound Puppies, Richie Rich, that kind of stuff. And when I would audition, I would always tend to give 3 or 4 different takes on a character, because your idea of what a, you know, an 8-year-old pony sounds like may be different than the guy sitting next to you. So it'd be smart to give options and let them know I'm versatile, I can take direction, that kind of thing. But with Bart, I don't know. It's like, Terry, I had this idea. I read the script. I got the idea of who this boy was, saw the, you know, the monologue, and just boom, I just nailed it on one take, didn't give him anything else. And sometimes it just works out that way.
So, there's nothing conscious going on when you did the voice, it just came to you.
Yeah, it just, no kidding, when I saw the picture, it really helps when you get the visual image of what the character looks like, because sometimes you might have a character whose jaw is sticking out a little bit more on the bottom than it is on the top, and he's got this sort of, there's a placement there, so you know that his lower teeth would be sticking out a little bit farther, so that would help in creating a character. Or say you've got a 7-year-old kid who's got a split in his 2 front teeth, or he's missing one of his teeth at age 7.
So he would be talking sort of like this, and you can put a sort of a sound in there, sort of like that little actress that played on Mrs. Doubtfire. So I can steal from, you know, Mara Wilson, I think was that little actress's name. I totally ripped that off from her. When I go to
the mall or just, you know, people watching, or I go to movies and watch television. I'm inspired by live action actors and recognizing sounds and trying to duplicate that. So I come up with an arsenal of characters in my head so then I can then at the next audition give them more options.
What lines, what Bart lines do people quote at you most often when they meet you?
Well, when people meet me and they'll mostly say, do Bart. That's how they do Bart, do Bart. No way, man. And everybody's happy. But I'll tell you, it creates such a great effect because they're blown away. Number one, that they heard it. Number two, that I did it without them asking. And I don't, number three, that it shocked them that I suppose that I did it at all.
So once you were cast, did the writers want to hear you do Bart so that they could write for you like in character? Or in order to do Bart, did the writers have to write for you so you knew who Bart was? Do you know what I mean? Like, your voice would help tell them who the character was, but their writing would help tell you who the character was.
You know what? Here it is. It's a very collaborative art form, and I believe probably it was through the process itself that there became sort of a symbiotic relationship between the writing and the actors, whereas we would be assigned parts, and Terry, that's not done. That is just, I don't know any other show that you would show up at the beginning. This was like in the early 90s and through the mid 90s when all the citizens of Springfield were being introduced into these scripts. I would get the script and all of a sudden it would say, Nelson Muntz, Nancy Cartwright. And I'm like, oh, wow. So the table read is, I would get my script delivered to me at like 2 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. And the script reading was at 10 o'clock that same morning. I had really little kids. I didn't have a lot of time to read the script. I'm like, oh, my God, I've got to come up with a whole character and read this in front of everyone with no guidance, no direction, nothing. We're just going to read this thing. And that's how we did it.
Well, why don't you describe who Nelson is and how you came up with his voice?
Well, Nelson, he was a bad boy, and I had to read the script because there's not much of a description in the script. It might say bad boy, but it didn't go into detail on it. So by reading the script and, you know, putting that in context, I realized he was just this, he was a thug. He was bigger physically than Bart. So he was also, I believe Nelson Muntz is a little bit older, even though he's in the fourth grade. But I just ended up coming up with the sound that I think Nelson has sort of evolved, and it came to the point where he eventually got a really, really rough sound like that. And he has got a really, really hard R's. And I don't know, that's how that sound came. And the laugh, the ha-ha, let me just say it for ha-ha, that was written in the script as it just said, I think it actually just said, ha ha. And I don't know, if somebody else would have been cast as that, they would have come up with their own idea of what that would sound like. But when I did that, it got an instant laugh. And so that stuck. And because I think it got that laugh, the writers put a little asterisk or a little star beside that. And they know that later on, they can do that again. And hopefully it'll continue to get a laugh. And it's through trial and error and through experimenting. I don't think anybody said, let's create a signature laugh for Nelson Muntz. Do you know what I mean? It's uh-huh. just something that sort of evolved. And I find that fascinating, too, in looking at the development of The Simpsons, that a lot of choices that we had the opportunity to make, they were just opportunities that we had. Nobody was going out there and saying, wow, when I do this, this is going to become a catchphrase. Next thing you know, this is, smell you later, that people are going to be saying that, you know?
When you do that gruff, like, Nelson voice, does that hurt your vocal cords at all? Like, is there a way of doing that without it hurting?
You know, he truly is he's the most challenging in terms of my vocal cords, but throughout the years and the 400-plus episodes that we've done so far, Nelson has only really been a lead character or citizen in just maybe a couple or three. One of my favorite ones was when it was that tribute when he came home and Marge really kind of took him under his wing and he sang that song. It was a tribute to, it was like a play on Yentl. I don't know if I can do it. Oh. Papa, can you hear me? He's singing to his father. Because his father, like, left to go get cigarettes or milk or something at the Quickie Mart. He never came. Papa, is that you? Is that you? Oh, Papa.
My guest is Nancy Cartwright. She's the voice of Bart Simpson and Nelson Muntz. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nancy Cartwright. She voices the characters of Bart Simpson, Nelson Muntz, and Todd Flanders on The Simpsons. Starting tomorrow, you can hear her in the new Simpsons movie. In the new Simpsons movie, as in the TV show, there are times when Homer strangles Bart.
Oh, sure.
So can you talk about what goes on between you and Dan Castellaneta when Homer's strangling Bart?
You know, that's another great one. I remember the first time that it was written in the script that happened, and I was just kidding. I said, Dan, why don't you come over and help me out? He did. He came across this, you know, he was standing on the opposite side of me. He walked all across the studio, stands behind me. He started choking me. I'm going, ah, 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 ah. And it, like, created that, and man, it was imprinted forever, and that's what we duplicated from then on out.
Am I right in saying, from based on your description, that when you're recording, like, the Simpsons movie or the TV show, that all the actors are in a room together, gathered around one or two microphones, but you're doing it in real time as a group?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's ideal. It's ideal that we're there so we can kind of play off of each other.
What's it like when you're doing both sides of the conversation? Say, like, Bart's talking to Nelson.
Yeah, that's fun. That's really, really fun. There was one show, I think it was a take on I think it was called Bart's Commandments, or it was some Ten Commandments show. It was a play on, took you back in time, and there was a scene where it was Bart, Nelson, Ralph, and Kearney, I believe. And, oh my God, the scene was like 3 pages long, and I was just talking to myself the entire time. And I remember doing it at the table read. I was so nervous to do it in front of that. There's like 100 people in the room, and I'm doing it just praying that I wouldn't get confused who I was. And I finished my run, and I was sweating. I was, like, really perspiring, and I was out of breath. There's no time to even breathe, practically. That is such a challenge. And yet, but if it's just like one scene, there was one scene where Bart had a Mr. Microphone, and he was in the bottom of the well pretending like he was somebody else, and Rod and Todd Flanders were next door, and they were picking him up on their radio. And Bart's like, Rod, Todd, this is God. What are you doing on our radio? What do you mean, what am I doing on the radio? I created the universe, stupid kid. What do you want from us? I want you to go to the kitchen and bring forth all the cookies from your kitchen. But those are our parents' cookies. What do you want, a God, a happy God or a vengeful God? Happy God, happy God. Then bring forth the cookies. Yes, sir.
It's
a challenge, but it's fun.
That's so great. What were some of the differences for you doing the voices for the Simpsons movie compared to the TV show? Is it any different?
Yeah, it was a little bit different. The TV show, just technically, we only have one mic. It's one mic in front of us. That's it. For the feature film, we had two. And if you think about it, you know, a movie theater is pretty big space. So they want to get the sound, the clarity of the vocals very precise. So we had two mics. And the only other thing that was really different was in terms of directing. For the television show, we would do 4 takes per scene. And in the feature film, oh man, we would do 20, 30, 30 takes sometimes. Just really trying to give a lot of options to Jim Brooks or Mike Scully or Al Jean so that they were really satisfied that they got every ounce of, you know, possible interpretation out of that line.
Yeah, so tell me more, like, what direction is like for an animated film.
I'll tell you, this is another thing that's something that I had, I'm really glad I kept my mouth shut on this, because I had been working on Saturday Morning Fair, and, you know, we didn't have rehearsals for our scripts, and to do a half-hour animated cartoon for a Saturday morning show, it took about, you know, like an hour and a half, 2 hours at the most to do one script. Well, very early on in The Simpsons, we'd go in at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we wouldn't finish till 9 o'clock at night. That was, to me, that was ridiculous. I'm like, oh my God, these people have no idea what they're doing. Why isn't anybody asking me? So I felt I'm the expert here, but I'm so glad I kept my mouth shut, Terry, because it evolved, and the group kind of came up with our own rules of how we were going to do this, and there was a group agreement as to how the production was going to go. So it would start at 10 and end at 9 o'clock, and then the second year, it was like started at 10 and we'd end at 6 o'clock, and as we evolved, we got better and more confident and more sure about what we were doing, so that the process actually was speeded up. Now we're in at 10 and we're out at 2.
Is there ever a time when you're given a script and you're thinking, I really need to see a visual to get what's going on here, to get what Bart is actually experiencing?
Wow, that's another great question. No, actually no, but I think partially is that especially after all these years, we can totally visualize what's going on. But you just got to do your homework. You just got to be prepared and know that if Bart is, you know, on a skateboard, or he's like riding his bicycle over a cliff and down a hill, that there's going to be, you know, and I just visualize it and like, how many seconds of this do you want? Well, make it a little bit longer. Do it again, but make it longer. Nancy, you know what? This isn't a show about him riding, you know, his bicycle over a cliff. Just cut it. Like, you got to cut that about. Just give me about a tenth of that. Yeah, okay, good. No problem. Because I don't know about the length of time for the animation.
Now, your mentor was Dawes Butler, who worked for Hanna-Barbera doing a lot of the great voices. Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw McGraw, Elroy Jetson. How were you lucky enough to meet him?
Oh my gosh, that's right. I was working at this radio station, and long story short, I connected up with someone who gave me her business card, and she forwarded my letter on to somebody else who then wrote me back, and in a letter was his name and phone number, and I called him up. And there, he had an answering machine, and this was like in 77. We didn't have answering machines in Dayton, Ohio, but this was Hollywood, you know. So I called him up and listened to his message, and it was a kind of an uptight kind of a butler guy.
Yes, hello. This is Percival Pickles, Mr. Butler's butler. Leave your name and address, and leave your message, and he'll get back to you. Wait for the beep, beep.
And I listened to that thing, and I'm like, oh, my God. I said,
hello, Mr. Butler. This is Nancy Cartwright of Dayton, Ohio.
And I just did a little character in return and left my, you know, left my address. And then I hung up the phone. I left my address. I said, just send me, you know, I said something like, please send me some information about your workshop. I'm interested in doing that. So, pip, pip, cheerio, and I hung up the phone. And I thought, you know, that was stupid. Why didn't I just leave my phone number? So I called him back. And I'm telling you, something like that, I think that impinges on somebody. He listened to my messages, and sure enough, he called me back. And here we are talking on the phone, and he's telling me a little bit about his workshop. And he said, I'll just send you something. You take a look at it and see what you think. Maybe you could put it on tape and send me the tape of it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you've got to be kidding me. Wow, okay, I'll do it. And thank you, Mr. Butler, and hung up the phone. And that started a long-distance student-mentor relationship that continued until, like about a year or so later, I knew I had to get out of there. I wanted to go be with him.
And did you do that?
Yeah, I transferred. I told my mom and dad I wanted to move to California, and you're going to go with me, and we'll, you know, I'll transfer to UCLA, and I got accepted and got in their theater department. But I lived for the Sundays that I caught the bus in Westwood, And I rode the bus to Beverly Hills and hopped off, walked a couple blocks to his house. He'd converted his garage into a studio. And I'd go back there for a one-hour lesson that lasted, like, the whole afternoon. He and his wife pretty much took me under their wings. And, I mean, this was, like, this guy really, really cared for me. It was a pretty special relationship.
What are some of the things that you learned by watching Dawes Butler work? I assume maybe, like, you went with him to Hanna-Barbera and watched him record cartoons. Was he retired by then?
Let's see. When he took me to Hanna-Barbera, no, he wasn't retired. He was still doing, he was doing Popeye. I think he was Wimpy, the guy that eats all the hamburgers.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing that. He was still doing Elroy. They were still doing the Jetsons, believe it or not. And here Dawes was well into his 70s. And, well, for that matter, Mel Blanc, same thing. He was into his 70s. And George O'Hanlon, who did the voice of George Jetson, he was in his 80s and still doing it. This is what amazes me. Okay, I'm about 5 barts worth. I'm way, way younger than, like, being into my 70s. I'm looking at The Simpsons and going, wow, is it possible that we could still be around for another 20 years? That, but you know what? Dave Merkin, at 200 episodes, Dave Merkin said at one of the table reads, well, we're halfway there. And it got a huge laugh, and then look what...
My guest is Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nancy Cartwright. She voices the characters of Bart Simpson, Nelson Muntz, and Todd Flanders on The Simpsons. Starting tomorrow, you can hear her in the new Simpsons movie. You said earlier that, you know, when like a lot of friends of yours who have children, or, you know, people you're just meeting who have children will introduce the kids to you and say, this is Nancy Cartwright, and she does the voice of Bart. And then they'll expect you to do the voice of Bart for the kids. What about your own kids? I mean, they grew up while you were doing The Simpsons. Did they do, like, Mommy, Mommy, do Bart for us?
As a parent, you kind of wonder what kind of influence you have on your kids in everything that you're doing, whether it's traveling, you know, to different countries or whatever. But when my son Jack was 2 years old, they had come out with a Bart Simpson. It was a prototype to see if the talking Bart doll would work. But the string on the thing was a little short, so it sort of sounded like Bart on helium, because it would be like, don't have a cow, man. Don't have a cow, man. But my son would pull the string, and it would say that, and he'd look at the string, and then he'd look at me. He'd pull it again, don't have a cow, man. And he'd look at me, and he'd said to me, Mommy, I don't see you in there. I don't see you in there. He's 2 years old. I'm telling you, that is a concept. Parents will come up to me and you know, I know that they want to hear me do the voice. But there's a three-year-old clutching onto Mama's skirt, and they're saying, could you do it for Sally? Could you do it? And I'm thinking, I'll just tell the parent, I don't have anything vested in this for a three-year-old kid that looks scared to death. If I was to lean down and say, hi, I'm Bart Simpson. Who the hell are you? You think that kid is going to like it? The kids look at me like I'm, you know, an alien, or they get upset. So I'll just say, look, I'll do it for you, but I'm not going to do it for your child. I just think that's wrong. It's too big of a concept.
Why do the kids get so upset?
Well, it's just, It's too big of a concept. They're looking at this woman who, they might watch The Simpsons, but a child, I really think that they are watching it through a child's eyes, and they enjoy the colors, and they like the different expressions and emotions that they see, whereas a teenager will cull something totally different out of that. They will start to recognize references. And of course, adults, I mean, we can get the satire and we can get more, of history and even more references than a teenager would get. So there's a whole cross-generational span of The Simpsons that entertains those audiences. But a kid, I don't know, man. I don't know how old I was before I realized that those sounds came from actors. It's a concept that's pretty, I'd say 5 and under. Just, this is a gross generalization. There are exceptions to the rule, no doubt about it. But generally speaking, I use some discretion on who I just throw that voice to.
Well, Nancy Cartwright, it's just been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, you bet.
Nancy Cartwright does the voice of Bart Simpson. The new Simpsons movie opens tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with another scene from The Simpsons TV show.
Hello, gents. What will it be?
Pooh, give us a super squishy.
One that's made entirely out of syrup.
Entirely out... An all-syrup super squishy? What's such a thing has never been done?
Just make it happen.
Oh dear. Oh, she won't hold. She's breaking up. All done. If you survive, please come again.
It's so thick. Bart!
Whoa, that's good squishy.
What's it like, Bart? Give me that!
Okay, we're young, rich, and full of sugar. What do?
Let's go crazy Broadway style!
Springfield, Springfield, it's a hell of a town. The schoolyard's up and the shopping mall's down. The stray dogs go to the animal pound. Springfield, Springfield,
Springfield, Springfield.
New York, New York.
New York is that away, man.
Thanks, kid.
It's a hell of a town.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 50th anniversary of the Memphis soul label Stax is being celebrated with concerts, reissues, and a PBS documentary. On the next Fresh Air, interviews with two of the people behind many Stax hits, Isaac Hayes and Steve Cropper. Join us.